Oh, say can we see by the one light in all our earth to embrace at the call of all nations where our children can play in a world without war where we stand hand in hand in the grace of creation where the rivers run clean through the forests of green where the cities stand tall in the clear skies of freedom. Oh, say do our hearts sing out for harmony and love forever on the planet of our birth, blessed with peace on Earth.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can review this program and previous programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is Iraqi Mass Deception and U.S. Moral Panic. In this program, Peter B. Collins interviews Scott A. Bond. In the book, Mass Deception, Scott A. Bond connects propaganda and distortion by the Bush administration to elite deviance and state crime and violations of international criminal law. Dr. Bond's book illustrates just how simple it is for those in the highest seats of power to deceive and manipulate ordinary, hardworking, trusting Americans into losing sight of what the truth really is and coercing them into sending their sons and daughters needlessly into harm's way. Warning, loyal Republicans may find some parts of this program difficult to understand.
Today, we're going to take a look back at the Bush administration. Our music of the moment from Australia's Midnight Oil. That's a powerful song if you listen closely to the lyrics. Peter Garrett, the leader of the band and the songwriter, left rock and roll to enter government. And last time I checked, he was the environment minister in Australia. There's been a change of administration down there, so he may have been shuffled out. But he speaks for me when he talks about my country, right or wrong, and decries the way that Americans were led like sheep into supporting Bush's war in Iraq and the ongoing war in Afghanistan. Scott A. Bond, Ph.D., joins us today. He is a criminologist, scholar, media expert, and assistant professor of sociology at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. His new book is called Mass Deception, Moral Panic and the U.S. War on Iraq. And Scott has a very interesting background. Before he went into academia, he was an advertising executive for NBC Television at a very high level, a vice president, and he was also executive VP at SonicNet, an internet music service that was formed in the 1990s, and he joins us today from the East Coast. Scott, thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me, Peter.
This is a powerful book because you underscore the psychology, the sociology, and the mass indoctrination of the American people in the attempt to infect world public opinion as well, that was largely successful when launched by the Bush administration as a new brand initiative, as Andrew Card, the chief of staff of the White House, once described it. Can you give us a quick sketch of yourself and how you became interested in moral panic? And then I'll ask you to define that as well.
Sure. My background, as you mentioned, Peter, is really on the corporate side. I worked for over 20 years in various capacities in media and advertising, both in agencies as well as in the media themselves at NBC. And I left that world right around 2000 to pursue a lifelong dream, which was to get involved in higher education and research and to pursue a master's degree and ultimately a PhD. And while I was doing that, along the way, I was familiarizing myself with this moral panic concept that has been around for a while but had never been applied to an event such as the build-up to a war.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me that at least by 2002, as we were listening to the war drums pounding by George W. Bush and his administration, that we were really living through a moral panic. And I should probably give the listeners a little background what moral panic, that concept is all about.
Please do. Mm-hmm.
It's essentially the notion that there are moments in history where it is in the best mutual interests of both the media and political elites to basically scare the hell out of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's there's almost a symbiotic relationship between the media and political elites in that they rely on one another. The media need the politicians for juicy stories, for content that they can disseminate, and then at the same time, political elites need the channels of communication to disseminate their rhetoric and you know, even propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not necessarily a conspiracy going on there, per se, but it's just in their best mutual interest sometimes. And to the extent that an event becomes very inflammatory and incites public agitation and fear, it can be in both of their best interests. And certainly for politicians to sell policy, and one of those policies could be to go to war. And so I applied this concept to the buildup of the war in Iraq, and I believe that I'm the first to really look at how propaganda can actually influence public opinion, in to the extent that I looked at the rhetoric of the Bush administration when they were using words like evildoers and madmen and axis of evil and weapons of mass destruction, that were terms that really came into existence after 9/11, and how as that rhetoric escalated and built and the volume got cranked up as we got closer and closer to war, how public opinion mirrored that rhetoric, and it was just reached a crescendo by March of 2003. So my analysis revealed just how powerful rhetoric can be in terms of manufacturing consent, to use one of Chomsky's terms.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book, a moral panic is the public and political response to an exaggeration or distortion of the threat posed to society by some allegedly threatening group or condition. And you cite Cohen, you say a moral panic includes an exaggeration of certain events based on empirical criteria such as the number of individuals involved, the level and extent of the threat or violence, and the amount of damage caused. And these are all very important factors that we're going to examine as we listen to some sound clips from the run-up to the war in Iraq. And before we get to that, explain the concept of folk devils, because this is something that first surfaced for me without that terminology. When Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, was president, and he, in a very personal way, demonized Manuel Noriega,
mm-hmm.
who we snatched from Panama amid blaring rock music, and, you know, he's locked up in a prison in Florida to this day. And then he personalized his confrontation with Saddam Hussein, called him Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always very mano a mano.
Mm-hmm.
And I considered that so out of bounds and almost ridiculous in the way they were trying to create these cartoon characters of evildoers, the kind of super madmen that we see in the big screen adaptations of comic books, whether it's Dick Tracy or Batman or anybody else. So talk a little bit about folk devil and why this is a primary tool in this kind of psychological shaping.
Absolutely. The term folk devil was coined by Stan Cohen. You mentioned Cohen. He was the one who really developed the moral panic concept in the late 1960s, early 70s. And it's been expanded then and used in other contexts, but never war. And the folk devil is basically the boogeyman. It's in any moral panic situation, you have either an individual, whether that be Noriega or Saddam Hussein, or an entire group. For example, we're living through a situation right now where anyone the Muslim religion has been demonized by certain groups. And so I think we have a bit of a panic going on once again. And but it's where a group basically is stripped of all humanity. And I liked your use of the almost the cartoon imagery, because that's exactly what the elites and those who attempt to create these folk devils try to do: strip a group or an individual of all humanity and morality. And by doing so, you've made a one-dimensional character out of them. And it's much easier to advocate for their extermination if you've stripped them of all humanity. And that's exactly what the attempt is to do with folk devils in a moral panic.
And there are five elements here, if you want to call this a recipe. Folk devils are the first component. Second, you say law enforcers like the police, the military, are vital to a moral panic. Third, the media, perhaps the most influential facilitator in the creation of a moral panic. We saw them embed themselves, and also the reporting was so nationalistic, as it was all us versus them. And interesting to note that during the first 6 months of 2003, and we invaded in March of 2003, CNN split their domestic and their international feeds. And on the domestic feeds, it was us versus them. And on the international feeds, it was much more detached. American forces referred to as they, in the detached third person. And I think that speaks volumes to the way that the media, and as you point out, I share your view that I don't see any overarching conspiracy. I know a lot of people like to try to draw those connections and see the media as really prostituting itself to government. But as you pointed out, it really was the mutual benefit that they saw this as a big ratings success, that it's like the Olympics. And you told me off air that you used to sell packages of the high-priced sponsorship deals for the Olympics for NBC.
That's right.
And I think the network saw this as a business opportunity.
Absolutely. Nothing sells like a war. And, by the time March 19th was reached in 2003, you could literally just sit there in your living room, make a bowl of popcorn, crack open a beer, and watch Armageddon taking place in Iraq. It was like it was almost surreal to be able to watch the they called it shock and awe, as the missiles were dropping, and horrific, but literally watching war, real time, like a movie.
But it was sanitized, too, because unlike media in other parts of the world, and the sharpest contrast was Al Jazeera, we often would not show the actual impact. We had these long shots, and, shock and awe looks like fireworks when you're sitting there watching your flat-screen TV. But we often would not show the actual impact, the human cost, the toll. We'd show buildings blown up, but we were very careful to sanitize out any body parts or, disfigured human beings.
Oh, absolutely. And let alone the soldiers' coffins coming home.
Right.
The Bush administration learned that from the Nixon administration. But you're so right. We saw a very sanitized version. So in to that regard, it almost was a cartoon like experience of watching war on TV, like a Terminator movie or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
moving along to the other two elements here, politicians are vital actors in a moral panic drama. As elected officials who must operate in the court of public opinion, politicians must present themselves as the protectors of the moral high ground. And here we saw limited courage. Barbara Lee, my congresswoman from Oakland, voted against the authorization to use military force, the Patriot Act, and there were more courageous people as time went on. But in the initial aftermath of 9/11, pretty much people left and right got in line and said, this is not a moment to stand out, to stand up for principle, or to ask any embarrassing questions. And so they really contributed as well. And then finally, the most important piece here is us, the public. Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize our own role in this. And I say our, even though I was a skeptic, and I can, you know, pat myself on the back and say I didn't believe this bullshit. But, you know, as a group, we were led into this, and most of us submitted without much of a struggle.
That's true. By March 19th, once again, of 2003, approximately 70% of the U.S. public was in the boat to go to war, so approved of the invasion, and almost an identical percentage, again, 70%, believed that Iraq was directly involved in the attacks of 9/11, and that they did have these alleged massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. So in this latter point, the propaganda campaign, the moral panic campaign, certainly worked on behalf of the Bush administration. But you're right, there certainly were dissenting voices. And it's interesting that you bring that up, Peter, because in my analysis, the statistical analysis that I did, I not only looked at the rhetoric of the Bush administration, but I did look at the rhetoric of certain dissenting voices, people like Hans Blix, certain congresspeople who were not in line with the march to war, and I looked at the effects of their rhetoric on public opinion, but they were essentially drowned out. When you controlled for the volume of the Bush administration's rhetoric, those other voices really had little to no impact at all.
Also, if you take a look at LexisNexis and see how much airtime on the major networks was and how many column inches of print in the major print publications were devoted to the voices of dissent, you can see that we were edited right out of any national debate, and there was, in fact, very little debate permitted over these issues, and those of us who spoke up were told to be careful.
That's right. That's right. In fact, Bush dichotomized the world right after 9/11. The world became us and them, good and evil, and you're either with us or you're against us. So if you don't go along with the marching orders, then you're part of the problem. And you mentioned the media, and not only do I believe that the U.S. media were simply following normal journalistic routines, and that is passively disseminating the rhetoric of the Bush administration as it was handed to them in bite-sized sound bites each day, but I also believe that there was this hypersensitivity after 9/11 to dissent in any way and to criticize or critique in any way, and for fear that you would be pointed out as being anti-American or not patriotic. Mm-hmm. So I think it just took a normally passive situation and made it perhaps even less likely that anyone would critique or criticize what the administration was doing.
We're talking with Scott Bond. The book is Mass Deception, subtitled Moral Panic in the U.S. War on Iraq. Scott, next, you define this moral panic as elite engineered. And this term elite gets bandied around quite a bit, and I'm not using the Sarah Palin definition, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right.
But how do you define elites in terms of the players who really were conscious of this and able to engineer it?
Okay. Yes, certainly the common usage of it, or the way that it's often used by conservatives, is that elites are the liberal intelligentsia or the liberal media. That is not what I'm talking about at all here. When I refer to elite engineered, I mean by the people who were really running the show at that time, and that is the Bush administration and those closest to them. And there have been so many reports that have come out after the fact. Intelligence Committee in 2006, their conclusion was that the Bush administration knew full and well that the so-called evidence that they were using against Iraq was faulty, and yet they came out and used it anyway. So Bush's claim recently in his memoir that everyone, he said that everyone believed that Iraq had these massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. It simply wasn't true. And his, much of his memoir, I believe, is really just an attempt to rewrite history according to his legacy and what he would like to say happened when, in fact, history is very, very different.
Indeed. And it includes some powerful admissions that a prosecutor might want to take a look at if we had a prosecutor taking a look at things like that.
Absolutely. The first proposition of my book is really that there was a propaganda campaign, that we were sold a bill of goods to go to war. But the second proposition in my book is that the Bush administration really committed war crimes. They violated all the sacred treaties of international law that were coined and co-authored by the United States after the atrocities of World War II. And the Bush administration has basically gotten away with it and will get away with it. And that's why I found it just so disturbing to watch Bush with Matt Lauer and watch him on his book tour, for which he was paid $7 million up front for that memoir. And no critical questions. No one is really criticizing in any way what happened, when I can tell you as a criminologist that international law, in fact, was violated.
We'll return to your second proposition in a bit. Next, Scott, I want to identify your brief descriptions of the five criteria of moral panic, and then I want to play some of these sound bites and ask you to give us examples. The criteria include concern, which can also be defined as fear, consensus, I'm turning the pages here, hostility, disproportionality, and volatility. And rather than define each of those point by point, I would ask you, as you listen to this first sound clip, to pull examples out that explain those criteria.
Sure.
And I do want to credit filmmaker Robert Greenwald for his documentary Uncovered, and he really changed many things in producing that documentary, because it was an anti-war documentary of great power and potency, because all of the voices were people with military or intelligence background. It was not just lefties like me or political figures. It was people whose lives had been devoted to our national security and national defense, who were sharply critical of this turn of events with the U.S. invasion of Iraq. So here is a quick collage, and you're going to hear the voices of Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, and Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
A clear threat to the United States.
And there's dozens of ballistic missiles.
It has sponsored and sheltered terrorists.
Paying suicide
chemical
bombers.
Chemical weapons are equally chilling.
Biological weapons, including anthrax and botulism toxins.
Biological and chemical agent to kill millions of people.
Chemical weapons, including VX and sarin, mustard gas.
To a massive and sudden horror.
Massive death and destruction.
Death on a massive scale.
Now, in addition to the coordinated language there, which really hits home when they use massive, three voices edited so tightly together, we really hear the elements of moral panic, Scott. So you take over and take as long as you like to describe that.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. The first element that you mentioned is concern, which you have to have in any moral panic. And that's just simply the expression that there is a problem at hand, that there is a threat. And certainly that's manifested throughout those sound bites, just the expression that there is a threat to U.S. Security. And so that would fulfill or demonstrate the concern criteria. Consensus. The second criteria is a little bit different. There, you need to measure it and really take almost a thermometer temperature of the public. And so there is where I used public opinion polls. And the public opinion polls showed me over a several year period how the public response and what the public response was to this a propaganda campaign that was being disseminated.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
In the chasm of our sorrow, let us not forget we are all believers in a truth stronger than death. Grant us healing for the suffering, comfort for the comfortless. in our pain, in our anger, let us still recall we are each of us a stranger, we are kindred all. As we find ourselves in heroes, so we'll also find our flaws. Let us find the strength that we will need to give us peace. In the anguish of our losses, let us not despair. While the light of freedom shines, let us choose our course.
Now for something completely different.